That was all he said at that time. About 20 days later, he called together the most distinguished Persians in his company and told them the following. Persians, I find myself forced to disclose to you the matter I have kept most carefully hidden of all. While I was in Egypt, I had a dream in my sleep, one I wish I had never had. It seemed to me a messenger came from home and reported that Smerdis, seated upon the royal throne, touched the sky with his head. Fearing that I would be robbed of my rule by my brother, I acted more hastily than wisely. For it seems that in human nature there is no power to turn aside what is destined to happen, and I, in my folly, sent Prexasps to Susa to kill Smerdis. When so great a crime had been carried out, I lived without fear, never once considering that, once Smerdis was removed, someone else might rise up against me. But in failing utterly to foresee what was to come, I have become a needless fratricide, and I am no less deprived of my kingship. For it was Smerdis the Magus, whom the god was showing me in my vision, would rise up against me. That deed, then, I have already done, and you must reckon that Smerdis, son of Cyrus, is gone from among you now. Your royal house is instead controlled by the Magi, the man I left as steward of my household, together with his brother Smerdis. The one man most bound to avenge the shameful wrong the Magi did to me has met an unholy death at the hands of his own closest kin. And now that he too is gone, the next urgent task remaining for you, Persians, is to charge you with what I wish to happen after my life ends. And so I lay this charge upon you, calling upon the royal gods, upon all of you, and especially upon those of the Achaemenidae who are present. Do not allow the rule to pass back again to the Medes. Rather, if they have taken possession of it by trickery, take it back from them by trickery. Or if they have seized it by force, recover it by force in return. And if you do this, may the earth bring forth its fruit for you, and your wives and your flocks bear young, and may you remain free for all time. But if you do not recover the rule, or if you do not even attempt to recover it, then I pray the opposite of all this may befall you, and moreover that each and every Persian may meet the same end that has befallen me. As he said these words, Cambyses wept over the whole his own doing. When the Persians saw the king in tears, they all grabbed hold of whatever clothing they wore and tore it, giving themselves over to boundless wailing. After this, once the bone turned gangrenous and the thigh rotted through in short order, it took the life of Cambyses, son of Cyrus, who had reigned in total 7 years and 5 months, leaving behind no offspring at all, male or female. Among the Persians present, there was strong disbelief that the Magi held power, and they supposed that Cambyses had spoken, as he did about the death of Smerdis, out of malice, so that all Persia would be roused to war against him. So they believed that Smerdis, son of Cyrus, was established as king, for Prexasps too strongly denied that he had killed Smerdis, since it was not safe for him, now that Cambyses was dead, to say that he had destroyed the son of Cyrus with his own hands. The Magus, then, after the death of Cambyses, reigned without fear, passing himself off as Smerdis, the namesake son of Cyrus, for the remaining 7 months needed to complete Cambyses' 8th year. During this time, he conferred great benefits on all his subjects, so that when he died, all the peoples of Asia missed him, except of the Persians themselves. For the Magus sent word to every nation under his rule, announcing freedom from military levy and tribute for 3 years. He issued this announcement right at the start of his reign, but in the 8th month he was found out in the following way. Atins was son of Pharnaspes, and in lineage and wealth ranked with the leading men among the Persians. This Atins was the first to grow suspicious of the Magus, that he was not Smerdis, son of Cyrus, but someone else, reasoning it out from the fact that he never went out from the citadel, and that he never summoned into his presence any of the eminent Persians. Suspecting this, he did as follows. Cambyses had taken as wife a daughter of his, whose name was Phidyme. This same woman the Magus now had, and lived with her as with all the other wives of Cambyses. So Atins sent word to this daughter of his, asking whom she was sleeping beside, Smerdis, son of Cyrus, or someone else. She sent back an answer saying she could not tell. She had never once set eyes on Smerdis, son of Cyrus, nor did she know the identity of the man sharing her bed. Atins sent a further message. Atins said, if you cannot recognize Smerdis, son of Cyrus, yourself, then go ask Adossa who this man is that both she and you share a bed with. Surely she at least would know her own brother. The daughter sent back this reply. I am unable to speak with Adossa, nor to catch sight of any other woman kept here alongside us, For as soon as this man, whoever he really is, took hold of the kingship, he scattered us, assigning each to a separate place. Hearing this, Aten saw the matter still more clearly. He sent a third message to her, saying this, Daughter, being well-born as you are, you must take on the risk that your father bids you undertake. For if this is not truly Smerdis, son of Cyrus, but the man I suspect, he must be stopped from rejoicing, from sleeping at your side while holding mastery over the Persians. He must pay for it. So do as I say. The next time he lies beside you and you can tell he is deep in sleep, feel for his ears. If he turns out to have ears, you may believe you are wedded to Smerdis, son of Cyrus. But if he has none, then know your husband is Smerdis the Magus. In answer to this, Phidime replied that she would be taking a great risk in doing this, for if he actually lacked ears and she were caught in the act of feeling for them, she was certain he would put an end to her. All the same, she agreed to try. So she promised her father she would carry it out. As for this Magus, this false Smerdis, Cyrus son of Cambyses, during his reign, had cut off his ears for some serious crime. So then this Phidime, the daughter of Aten's, carrying out everything she had promised her father, when her turn came around to go to the Magus, for the women take turns visiting the Persian king, came to him and lay with him, and when the Magus was sleeping soundly, she felt for his ears. Discovering, without difficulty but quite readily, that the man had no ears, as soon as day came she sent word and informed her father of what had happened. Aten's then took Espathanes and Gabrias, who were among the foremost of the Persians and most trustworthy to himself, and told them the whole matter. They too, it turned out, had themselves suspected that this was so, and when Aten's brought forward his account they accepted it, and it was resolved that each of them should take on as a partner the Persian each trusted above all others. Aten's accordingly brought in Tafrens in, Gabrias brought Megabizus, and Espathanes brought Hydarnes. Once these six were joined, Darius son of Histaspes reached Susa, having just come from Persia, where his father held the governorship. As soon as he arrived, the six decided to bring Darius into their number as well. Together, now numbering seven, they exchanged with one another pledges and exchanged words. And when it came Darius's turn to declare his opinion, he said to them, I had supposed that I alone knew this, that it is the Magus who is reigning, and that Smerdis son of Cyrus is dead. And it is for this very reason that I have come in haste, so as to bring about the Magus's death. But since it has turned out that you too know it, and not I alone, it seems to me that we should act at once and not delay, for delay is not better. To this, Aten's replied, Son of Histaspes, you are the son of a noble father, and you seem to be showing yourself in no way inferior to him. Do not, however, rush this undertaking so recklessly, take it up rather with more prudence, for we must become more numerous before making the attempt. To this, Darius said, Men here present, if you follow the course Aten's proposes, know that you will perish most wretchedly. For someone will carry word to the Magus, seeking gain for himself alone. You ought, above all, to have done this relying on yourselves alone. But since you saw fit to bring more people into it, and you have put it to me as well, either let us act today, or know this. If the present day passes by, then no one else will accuse me before anyone else can, but I myself will go and denounce you all to the Magus. To this Aten's replied, seeing Darius so pressing, Since you force us to act in haste and will not allow delay, come, explain yourself by what means we shall enter the palace and make our attempt upon them. You know as well as I do that there are guards posted throughout, even if you know it not by sight but by report. How shall we get past them? Darius answered him thus, Aten's, there are many things that cannot be shown in words but can be in deeds, and there are others that can be told in words, yet from which no brilliant deed results. You should know that the guards now posted are in no way difficult to get past. For, being the men we are, he will not refuse, partly out of respect for us, partly perhaps out of fear. And I myself have the most fitting pretext by which to gain entry, claiming that I have just arrived from Persia and wish to convey some message from my father to the king. Where a lie is needed, let it be told. For we who lie and those who deal in truth are both after the same thing. Some lie when they expect to profit by persuading with falsehoods, others speak the truth in order to draw profit by truth, and so be trusted the more. Thus, though we practice opposite things, we aim at the same end. If neither stood to gain anything, the truth-teller would be just as ready to lie as the liar to tell the truth. Now whichever of the gatekeepers lets us pass willingly, it will go better for him in time to come. But whoever tries to resist, let him then be shown to be our enemy, and after that, let us thrust our way in and get to work. After this, Gobryia said, Friends, when will we have a finer occasion to win back our rule? Or, if we prove unable to recover it, to die, then now? Now that we, Persians, are ruled by a Median man, a Magus, and one who has no ears at that. Those of you who were present when Cambyses lay dying surely remember what he charged upon the Persians as he ended his life, that they should try to win back the rule. At the time we did not accept it, but thought Cambyses spoke out of malice. Now then, I cast my vote that we obey Darius and not disband from this gathering, but go straight against the Magus. So spoke Gobryas, and every one of them agreed with this plan. While they were still working out these details, the following happened by pure coincidence. The Magi, in their own council, decided to draw Prexasps to their side as a friend, both because he had been wronged terribly by Cambyses, who had shot his son with an arrow and killed him, and because he alone knew the manner of Smerdis, son of Cyrus's death, having slain him with his own two hands, and further because Prexasps stood in the highest regard among the Persians. It was for these reasons that they called on him, sought his friendship, and bound him with pledges and oaths that he would guard the secret and tell no one of the fraud they had worked upon the Persians, promising in exchange to shower him with every kind of gift. Once Prexasps agreed to this, and the Magi had won him over, they came to him with a second request. They would gather all the Persians beneath the palace wall, and they told him to climb a tower and announce to the crowd that Smerdis, son of Cyrus, and no other, ruled over them. They gave him this task precisely because he was regarded as the most trustworthy man in Persia, and had many times stated his belief that Smerdis, son of Cyrus, still lived, denying any part in his murder. When Prexasps agreed that he was willing to do this as well, the Magi called the Persians together, brought him up onto the tower, and bade him speak. But of the things they wanted from him, he willingly forgot all of that. Instead, beginning from Achaemenes, he traced the lineage of Cyrus's line, and when at last he came down to Cyrus himself, he told all the good things Cyrus had done for the Persians. And having gone through these, he revealed the truth, saying that before he had hidden it, for it would not be safe for him to reveal the truth. But under his present circumstances, he found himself forced to speak plainly. So he declared that he himself, under compulsion from Cambyses, had slain Smerdis, son of Cyrus, and that the ones now ruling were the Magi. Then, after invoking many curses upon the Persians should they fail to reclaim their rule and punish the Magi, he let himself fall headlong from the top of the tower. Prexasps, then, a man of good repute all his life, ended his life in this way. As for the seven Persians, once they had resolved to attack the Magi at once without delay, they set out after praying to the gods, knowing nothing of what had happened concerning Prexasps. They were in the middle of their journey when they learned what had befallen Prexasps. At this, they stepped aside from the road and began to confer among themselves once more. Those siding with Otanes insisted firmly that they wait and not strike while things were still unsettled, while those siding with Darius pressed to act right away and carry out their plan without further delay. In the middle of this dispute, seven pairs of hawks appeared, chasing two pairs of vultures and tearing at their feathers. When the seven men saw this, they all Darius's judgment, and then went on toward the palace, emboldened by the omen of the birds. When they came to the gates, it happened just as Darius's judgment had foretold. The guards, out of respect for these men, who were the foremost among the Persians, and suspecting nothing of the kind from them, let them pass by, as if under divine escort, and no one questioned them at all. When they had passed into the courtyard, they encountered the eunuchs who carry in messages. These men asked them what they wanted, and while questioning them also threatened the gatekeepers for letting them through, and tried to hold back the seven, who wished to go further in. But the seven, urging one another on and drawing their daggers, cut down on the spot those who were holding them back, and themselves ran at a sprint into the men's hall. The two Magi happened at that moment to be both inside, taking counsel about what had happened concerning Prexasps. When they saw the eunuchs in an uproar and shouting, both of them ran back and, once they understood what was happening, turned to defend themselves. One of them managed to snatch up his bow, the other turned to his spear. Then they clashed with one another. Since he had grabbed his bow while the enemy stood close and pressing, It proved worthless to him, but the other man fought back with his spear, striking Aspathanes in the thigh and Intafrens in the eye. Intafrens lost the eye from that wound, though it did not kill him. So it was one of the two magi who wounded these men, but the other, when his bow proved of no use to him, since there was a chamber opening off the men's hall, fled into it, wishing to shut the doors against them, and two of the seven burst in with him, Darius and Gobryas. As Gobryas grappled with the magus, Darius stood over them at a loss, as one would be in the dark, being careful not to strike Gobryas instead. Gobryas, seeing him stand there doing nothing, asked why he did not use his weapon. Darius replied, "I am watching out for you so I don't strike you by mistake." Gobryas answered, "Push the blade through us both if you have to." Darius did as told, drove in his dagger, and happened to strike the magus. After killing the magi and cutting off their heads, the wounded among the seven were left behind both from injury and to keep watch over the citadel, while the remaining five carried the heads of the magi and ran through the streets shouting and raising a clamor, calling out to the rest of the Persians, telling them what had happened and holding up the heads, killing every magus they came across as they went. Once the Persians understood from the seven what had taken place and learned of the magi's deceit, they too judged it right to act the same way, drawing their daggers and killing every magus they could find. Had night not fallen and put a stop to it, not a single magus would have survived. To this day, the Persians hold this date above all others in shared observance and mark it with a great festival they call the Magophonia Slaying of the Magi, during which no magus is permitted to appear in public, but the magi keep themselves at home within doors that whole day. When the uproar had settled down and 5 days had passed, those who had risen against the magi took counsel about the whole state of affairs, and speeches were made that are disbelieved by some of the Greeks, but they were made nonetheless. Ataines urged that the government be laid open in common to the Persians, speaking as follows. "It seems to me that we should no longer have any one man as sole ruler, for that is neither pleasant nor good. You saw how far the insolence of Cambyses went, and you had your share too of the insolence of the magus. How could monarchy be a well-ordered thing when it allows a man to do whatever he wishes without being held to account? Even the best of all men, set in that position, would be driven out of his accustomed way of thinking. For insolence is bred in him by the good things he has at hand, while envy is inborn in man from the beginning. Possessing these two things, he possesses all wickedness, for he does many reckless things, some out of surfeit bred by insolence, others out of envy. And yet a tyrant of all men ought to be free of envy, having every good thing. But he is naturally the opposite of this toward his citizens. He envies the finest citizens who remain and are still living, while favoring the worst sort among the people, and is quick to welcome slander. Nothing about him is more contradictory. Show him modest respect, and he resents not being flattered enough. Lavish praise on him instead, and he resents that too, calling it mere flattery. But now I turn to the gravest charge of all. He upends the customs of the ancestors, violates women, and executes men without a trial. But rule by the many has, first of all, the fairest name of all, equality under the law Isonomia. And second, it does none of the things a monarch does. Offices are assigned by lot, the office holder is accountable for his conduct, and all deliberations are referred to the common body. I therefore cast my vote that we do away with monarchy and increase the power of the people, for in the many is everything. Such was the opinion Ataines put forward, but Megabyzus urged that they entrust power to an oligarchy, speaking as follows. What Ataines said in doing away with tyranny, let it stand as said by me too. But in urging that we hand power over to the many, he has missed the best judgment. For there is nothing so senseless and so insolent as a useless mob. And yet, for men fleeing the insolence of a tyrant to fall into the insolence of an unrestrained populace is in no way to be endured. For if the one, whenever he does anything, he acts knowing what he does. But the mob has not even the capacity to know. For how could one know anything, who has neither been taught nor seen for himself anything noble and fitting? It rushes into affairs and pushes them along without judgment, like a river in flood. Let those who wish the Persians harm make use of the people's rule then, but let us, choosing out a group of the best men, invest these with power, for among them we ourselves will also be, and it stands to reason that the best men produce the best counsels. We would fall into, It stands to reason that the finest men would produce the finest decisions. This was the view Megabyzus advanced. Darius spoke third, offering his own opinion. What Megabyzus said about mass rule strikes me as correct, but what he said about oligarchy does not. Of the three systems on the table, granting that each is excellent in its own way, rule by the best of the people, rule by the few, and rule by one, I say that monarchy far surpasses the rest. For nothing could show itself better than the rule of one man who is the best. Exercising judgment of that sort, he would govern the mass of people without fault, and plans against enemies would best be kept secret under such a rule. In an oligarchy, however, among the many who cultivate excellence for the common good, strong private feuds tend to arise. For each man, wanting to be foremost and to have his own counsels prevail, comes into violent enmity with the others. From which factions arise, and from factions, killing, and from killing the outcome is monarchy, and in this it is shown how much better monarchy is than the rest. Again, when the people rule, it is impossible that corruption not arise, and once corruption arises in public affairs, no enmities arise among the wrongdoers, but rather strong friendships, for those who do wrong to the common good act in collusion with one another. And this goes on until someone comes forward as champion of the people and puts a stop to such men. As a result of this, he is admired by the people, and being admired, he is shown to be a monarch. And in this too, it is proved that monarchy is the strongest form. To sum up everything in one word, from where did our freedom come and who gave it to us? From the people, or from oligarchy, or from a monarch? I hold then that we who have been freed through one man ought to preserve such a form of rule, and besides this, not to abolish our ancestral customs when they are good, for that would not be better. These then were the three opinions set forth, and four of the seven men sided with this one. When Ottanes, who had been urging that the Persians establish equality of rights, was defeated in his opinion, he said this to them in the midst of the group. Fellow conspirators, it is clear that one of us must become king, whether chosen by lot, or by entrusting the choice to the mass of the Persians and letting them pick whom they will, or by some other means. I myself will not compete with you for it, for I wish neither to rule nor to be ruled. But I withdraw of the throne, provided that none of you rules over me, neither I myself nor any descendant of mine, ever. Once he had said this and the six others agreed to his terms, he took no further part in the contest but stepped away from it, and even now his household alone remains free among the Persians, obeying only such laws as it chooses, so long as it does not break the laws of the Persians. The remaining six of the seven then deliberated how they might most justly set up a king. And it was decided, in the case of Ottanes and his descendants forever, that if the kingship should pass to any other of the seven, Ottanes and his line should receive as a special privilege a Median robe each year, and every gift that is held in highest honor among the Persians. This privilege they resolved to grant him these terms, since he had been the one to first devise the plan and bring the group together. Such were Ottanes's special privileges. But for the common good, they further decided that any of the seven could enter the royal quarters unannounced, except when the king was found asleep beside a wife, and that the king could take a wife only from among the families of the conspirators. As for the kingship itself, they resolved as follows: that whichever man's horse should neigh first at sunrise, when they were mounted in the suburb, he should have the kingship. Now Darius had a groom, a clever man whose name was Obares. To this man, after they had parted, Darius said the following: Obares, we have decided to settle the kingship in this way. Whoever's horse neighs first at the same moment as the sun rises, while we are mounted, he is to have the kingship. Now then, if you have any cleverness, contrive some way that we may win this prize, and not someone else. Obares answered him thus: Master, if indeed it is on this that it depends whether you become king or not, take courage on this account and keep a good heart, for no other man will be king before you. I have such devices at my command. Darius said, If then you have some such trick, it is time to contrive it and not to delay, since tomorrow is the day of our contest. Having heard this, Obares did as follows. When night came, he took one of the mares, the one which Darius's horse loved most, led her to the suburb and tethered her there, and then brought Darius's horse up, and led him around near the mare many times, letting him come close to her, and at last let him mount her. At the break of day, the six, as they had agreed, appeared on their horses. And as they rode out through the suburb, when they came to the spot where the mare had been tethered the night before, there Darius's horse ran forward and let out a neigh. At the very instant the horse did this, lightning flashed from a clear sky and thunder rolled. These signs, coming right after what had already happened to Darius, sealed his kingship as though arranged in advance, and the other riders sprang down from their horses and bowed before Darius. Some claim Oberes engineered this trick, while others tell a different story, for the Persians report it both ways, that he had touched this mare's genitals with his hand and kept it hidden in his trousers, and that when, at sunrise, the horses were about to be released, this Oberes drew out his hand and brought it up to the nostrils of Darius's horse, and the horse, perceiving the scent, snorted and neighed. So Darius, son of Hystaspes, was declared king, and all the peoples of Asia were subject to him, except the Arabians, since Cyrus had subdued them and later Cambyses again. The Arabians never submitted to slavery under the Persians, but became friends by allowing Cambyses passage against Egypt, for the Persians could not have invaded Egypt against the will of the Arabians. Darius married the foremost marriages among the Persians, two daughters of Cyrus, Adossa and Artistone, Adossa, who had previously been married to Cambyses first to his brother, and then again to the Magus, while Artistone remained unmarried. He also wed another daughter of Cyrus, this one Smerdes's sister, named Parmes, and he took as well the daughter of Atenes, the woman who had exposed the Magus, so that every form of power was now his in full measure. First he had a stone relief carved and set up, showing the figure of a mounted horseman, and he had letters engraved on it reading, "Darius son of Hystaspes won the kingship of the Persians through the courage of his horse, naming the horse, and of Oberes his groom." After doing this, he set up 20 administrative districts across Persia, what the Persians themselves term satrapies. Having established these districts and placed governors over them, he fixed the tribute payments owed to him by nation, attaching neighboring peoples to each district, passing over the nearer ones and assigning peoples that lay farther off to different provinces. He divided the provinces and the yearly income of tribute as follows. Those of them who brought silver were ordered to bring it by the Babylonian standard of weight, those who brought gold by the euboic standard. The Babylonian talent is equal to 78 euboic minas. For under the rule of Cyrus and again of Cambyses, there had been no fixed any tribute at all, offering gifts instead. Because of this system of imposed tribute and other similar practices, the Persians have a saying that likens Darius to a shopkeeper, Cambyses to a master, and Cyrus to a father. The first because he reduced everything to buying and selling, the second because he was harsh and careless, and the third because he was kind and arranged only good things for them. From the Ionians, the Magnesians of Asia, the Aeolians, the Carians, the Lycians, the Melians, and the Pamphylians, since a single tribute was assessed across all of them, came 400 silver talents. This formed the first tax district. From the Mysians, Lydians, Lasonians, Cabalians, and Hytenians came 500 talents. This was the second district. From the Hellespontines on the right side going in, the Phrygians, the Thracians of Asia, the Paphlagonians, the Mariandinians, and the Syrians, the tribute amounted to 360 talents. This was the third district. From the Cilicians came 360 white horses, one for every day of the year, plus 500 talents of silver, of which 140 went toward the cavalry that guarded the land of Cilicia, and the remaining 360 went to Darius. This was the fourth province. From the city of Poseidium, which Amphilochus son of Amphiaraus founded on the border between the Cilicians and the Syrians, beginning from that city as far as Egypt, excluding the portion belonging to the Arabians, which was exempt from tribute, the tribute was 350 talents. In this province is included all Phoenicia and the part of Syria called Palestine and Cyprus. This was the fifth province. From Egypt and the Libyans bordering on Egypt, and from Cyrene and Barca, for these were reckoned into the Egyptian province, 700 talents came in, apart from the silver that comes from the fishing of Lake Moeris. Apart from the silver, and grain measured out in addition brought in 700 talents. for grain is portioned out to the Persian garrison of 200,000 men stationed at the White Fortress in Memphis, along with their auxiliaries. This was the 6th district. The Satigidae, Gandarians, Dadaki, and Aparati, taxed together as one, contributed 170 talents. This was the 7th district. Along with the rest of Sishan territory, 300 talents, this made the 8th district. From Babylon and the remainder of Assyria came 1,000 silver talents plus 500 boy eunuchs. This was the 9th district. From Ecbatana and the rest of Media, along with the Paracanians and Orthocorabantians, came 450 talents. This was the 10th district. The Caspians, Posaki, Pantamathi, and the Darati, combining their payments, brought in 200 talents. This was the 11th district. From the Bactrians up to the Eagli, the tribute stood at 360 talents. This was the 12th district. From Pactius, the Armenians and their neighbors as far as the Euxine Sea came 400 talents. This was the 13th district. From the Sagartians, Sarangians, Thamanians, Eutians, and the Mycians, together with those living on the islands in the Red Sea, where the king resettles the people known as deportees, from all of these combined the tribute amounted to 600 talents. This was the 14th district. The Sakian Caspians contributed 250 talents. This was the 15th district. The Parthians, Chorasmians, Sogdians, and Arians brought in 300 talents. This was the 16th province. The Paracanians and the Ethiopians from Asia brought in 400 talents. This was the 17th province. On the Mashani, the Saspires, and the Illyrodians 200 talents were imposed. This was the 18th province. On the Moscai, the Tiberini, the Macrons, the Mossinosi, and the Mares 300 talents were laid down. This was the 19th province. Of the Indians is by far the largest population of any people known to us, and paid, on top of all others, a tribute of 360 talents in gold dust. This was the 20th district. Converting the Babylonian silver talent into euboic measure gives 9,880 talents. And reckoning gold as worth 13 times as much as silver, the gold dust works out to 4,680 plus 600 talents, 4,000 in all. Adding together the total of all these sums in euboic talents, the yearly tribute gathered for Darius came to 14,560. I leave out anything smaller than this and do not bother listing it. This was the tribute reaching Darius from Asia and a small portion of Libya. As time passed, however, additional tribute began arriving from the islands and from the peoples settled in Europe up to Thessaly. The king stores this tribute away in the following fashion. He melts the metal and pours it into clay jars, and once a jar is full, he breaks away the clay shell around it. Then, whenever money is needed, he chips off however much the occasion calls for. Such, then, were the administrative districts and their assigned tributes. Persia itself is the one land I have not listed among the tribute payers, for the Persians occupy their land tax-free. The following peoples were assigned to bring no tribute at all, but gifts instead. The Ethiopians bordering on Egypt, whom Cambyses subdued when he marched against the long-lived Ethiopians, and those who dwell around sacred Nyssa and hold festivals in honor of Dionysus. These Ethiopians and their neighbors use the same seed as the Indians of Kalantia, who instead live in dwellings dug into the ground. Both these groups together used to bring their gifts every third year, and continue doing so even now, in my own day. 2 chonixes of unrefined gold, 200 blocks of ebony, and 20 large elephant tusks, along with 5 Ethiopian boys. The Colchians fixed their own gift amount, as did their neighbors up to the Caucasus Mountains, for Persian rule extends only as far as this mountain empire extends, but the peoples to the north of the Caucasus pay no further heed to the Persians. These peoples, then, still bring even to my time the gifts they set for themselves every 4 years, 100 boys and 100 girls. The Arabians brought in 1,000 talents of frankincense each year. Such were the gifts these peoples brought the king apart from the tribute. As for this great quantity of gold which the Indians bring in, from which they carry to the king the gold dust I have mentioned, they acquire it in the following manner. There is in the part of India toward the rising sun a region of sand. For of all the peoples we know, and of whom anything reliable is reported, the Indians dwell farthest toward the dawn and the sunrise among the peoples of Asia. For to the east of the Indians, the land is desert because of the sand. India has many tribes speaking different languages from one another. Some are nomadic and some are not, and some live in the marshlands of the river, eating raw fish that they catch from boats built out of reeds, each boat fashioned from a single length of reed. These Indians dress in clothing made of rush fiber. Whenever they harvest reeds from the river and cut them down, they weave the fibers together in the style of a basket and slip it on like body armor. Other Indians, living further east than these, are nomadic and eat their meat raw. These people are called the Paddy, and their customs are reportedly of this sort. When a townsperson falls sick, whether female or male, if it is a man, the men closest to him kill him, claiming that his flesh would be spoiled by the wasting sickness if he wastes away. He himself denies that he is sick, but they, not believing him, kill him anyway and feast on him. And if a woman falls ill, the women closest to her do likewise, just as the men do. For as for one who reaches old age, they sacrifice him and feast on him, but very few of them reach that point, for before that they kill anyone who falls into sickness. Other Indians follow yet another custom. They kill no living thing, nor do they sow anything, nor do they think it right to have houses, and they live on plants. And they have a grain the size of millet growing in a husk, which springs up from the earth of its own accord, and which they gather, husk and all, and boil and eat. And whoever among them falls into sickness goes off into the desert and lies there. No one pays any heed to him, whether he dies or is merely ill. The intercourse of all these Indians whom I have described is open to view, like that of cattle, and they all have skin of the same color, resembling that of the Ethiopians. Their seed, moreover, which they emit into the women, is not white like that of other men, but black, just as their skin is. Such is the seed which the Ethiopians also emit. These Indians dwell farther from the Persians and to the south, and never came under the rule of King Darius. Other Indians border on the city of Caspiteris and the land of Pactius, dwelling to the north of the other Indians, and they follow a way of life similar to that of the Bactrians. These are also the most warlike of the Indians, and it is they who set out after the gold, for it is in this region that there is desert because of the sand. Now in this desert and in the sand there live ants, smaller in size than dogs but larger than foxes. Some of them are kept even at the court of the Persian king, having been caught there. These ants, in making their dwelling underground, throw up the sand just as the ants among the Greeks do, in the very same manner, and they are also very similar to them in form. And the sand that is thrown up is rich in gold. It is after this sand that the Indians set out into the desert, each yoking together three camels, with a male camel harnessed on either side by a trace, and a female in the middle. The man himself mounts on this one, taking care to have yoked her after pulling her away from her young while they were as young as possible. For their camels are no slower than horses in speed, and besides are far more capable of carrying loads. As for the appearance of the camel, since the Greeks already know it, I will not describe it. But what they do not know about it, I will tell. A camel has in its hind legs four thighs and four knees, and its genitals, between the hind legs, turned toward the tail. The Indians, then, using this method and this kind of yoking, drive out after the gold, calculating so as to be engaged in the seizure while the heat is at its fiercest, for in the heat the ants become invisible, going underground. Now the sun is hottest for these people in the morning, not at midday as for others, but from sunrise until the time the marketplace empties. During this time, it burns much more fiercely than at midday in Greece, so much so that it is said men soak themselves in water at that hour. At midday the sun burns the Indians about as much as it burns other men. But as midday declines, the sun becomes for them like the morning sun is for others, and from that point onward, as it departs, it grows ever cooler, until at sunset it is very cold indeed. So when the Indians arrive at the place carrying sacks, they fill these with the sand and drive back as fast as they can. For at once the ants, catching the scent, as indeed it is said by the Persians, notice and give chase. And their speed, it is said, is unmatched by anything else, so that if the Indians did not get a head start on the road while the ants were gathering, not one of them would escape alive. Now the male camels, since they are slower in running than the females, are said to fall behind, being pulled along, not both together. But the females, remembering the young they left behind, hold back nothing in their effort. This, then, is how the Indians get most of their gold, according to the Persians. But another kind, scarcer, is dug up in their country. It seems that the outermost regions of the inhabited world happen to have received the finest things, just as Greece has received by far the finest and best-tempered climate. For to the east, the last of the inhabited lands is India, as I said a little earlier. India's living creatures, both four-footed animals and birds, grow to a far greater size there than anywhere else, with the exception of horses, which are surpassed by the Median breed, known as Nisaean horses. Additionally, gold exists there in vast quantity, some dug from mines, some washed down by rivers, and some snatched away by ants, as I already described. Wild trees growing there produce a fruit resembling wool, finer in appearance and quality than sheep's wool, and the Indians make their garments from this tree fiber. Moving further south, Arabia marks the edge of the inhabited world, and it alone among all lands produces frankincense, along with myrrh, cassia, cinnamon, and ledanin. Everything on this list besides myrrh is hard for the Arabians to acquire. They gather frankincense specifically by burning storax, the very storax the Phoenicians ship out to Greek markets. Burning it is how they capture the frankincense resin. This is because the trees that bear frankincense are watched over by winged snakes, small in size and dappled in color, clustered in large numbers around every single tree. These are the same creatures that invade Egypt in swarms, and smoke from the burning storax is the only thing that will drive them away from the trees. The Arabians also say this, that the whole land would be filled with these snakes, if it were not that something happens to them of the sort I understand happens to vipers. And somehow the foresight of the divine, being wise as indeed is fitting, has made all creatures that are cowardly and edible prolific in offspring, so that they may not be wiped out by being devoured, while creatures that are savage and troublesome it has made to bear few young. For instance, the hare is hunted by every kind of beast, bird, and man, and so it is extremely prolific. Alone among all animals it can conceive while already pregnant, and one of the young in the womb is already furred while another is bald, another is just being shaped in the womb, and another is only just conceived. So much for that. The lioness, though the strongest and boldest of creatures, bears only one cub in her whole life, giving birth once and for all. For in giving birth, she expels her womb along with the cub. The reason for this is as follows. When the cub, still in the mother, begins to stir, it has claws far sharper than those of any other animal, and it scratches the womb. And as it grows, it tears deeper still, scoring the womb, and by the time birth is near, nothing whole is left of it. In just the same way, if the vipers and the winged snakes of Arabia were born as their nature intends, life would not be livable for men. But as it is, when they mate in pairs and the male is in the very act of ejaculating, the female seizes him by the throat, and having clamped on, she does not let go until she has bitten right through. So the male dies in the manner described, but the female pays this penalty in turn to the male. In vengeance for the father, the young, while still in the womb, gnaw through their mother, and having eaten through her belly, thus make their way out. The other snakes, which do no harm to men, lay eggs and hatch a great quantity of young. Now vipers are found over the whole earth, but the winged snakes are found gathered together only in Arabia and nowhere else. That is why they seem to be so numerous. This, then, is how the Arabians obtain their frankincense, and this is how they get their cassia. When they have bound, covering their whole body and face, except for the eyes themselves, in hides and other skins, they set out after the cassia. It grows in a lake that is not deep, and around and within it live winged beasts closely resembling bats, which screech horribly and fight fiercely when threatened. The harvesters must fend these off away from their eyes as they cut the cassia. The cinnamon they gather in a still more remarkable way. Where it grows and what land nurtures it, they cannot say, except that some, reasoning plausibly, say it grows in the very regions where Dionysus was raised. They say that large birds carry these sticks, the ones we, having learned the word from the Phoenicians, call cinnamon, and that the birds carry them to nests built of clay and stuck onto sheer cliff faces, where no man can climb. So against this, the Arabians have devised the following trick. They cut up the limbs of dead oxen and donkeys and other pack animals into the largest pieces they can, carry them to these places, and having set them down near the nests, they withdraw far off. And the birds, flying down, carry the limbs of the pack animals up to their nests, which cannot bear the weight and break and fall to the ground, and the men then come and gather it up. In this way, the cinnamon collected from these places reaches the other countries. As for ladinin, which the Arabians call ladinin, it comes about in a way even more remarkable than this, for it forms in the foulest smelling place and yet is itself the sweetest smelling of things. For it is found forming on the beards of he-goats, like a kind of gum from the brush. It is useful for many kinds of perfume, and the Arabians burn it above all as incense. Let this much be said about spices, and the whole land of Arabia gives off a scent wondrously sweet. They also have two kinds of sheep worthy of wonder, found nowhere else. One of these sheep have tails so long, no less than 3 cubits, that if left to drag along, sores would form where the tails scraped against the ground. But nowadays every shepherd has learned enough woodworking skill to solve this. They build small carts and strap them beneath the tails, binding each animal's tail to its own individual cart. As for the second breed of sheep has tails that are broad, as much as a cubit wide. As one turns south, toward the setting sun lies Ethiopia, the last of the inhabited countries. This land produces much gold, abundant elephants, every kind of wild tree, ebony, and men who are the tallest, most handsome, and longest-lived. These, then, are the outermost regions of Asia and of Libya. About the outermost regions of Europe, toward the west, I cannot speak with certainty. For I myself do not accept that there is a river called by the barbarians the Eridanus, flowing out into the sea toward the north wind, from which amber is said to come, nor do I know of any islands called the Cassiterides, from which our tin comes. For in the first place the name Eridanus itself proclaims that it is Greek and not barbarian, and was coined by some poet. And in the second place, though I have taken pains to inquire, I have never been able to hear from anyone who had actually seen it that there is a sea beyond Europe. In any case, it is from the farthest regions that our tin and amber come to us. To the north of Europe there evidently is a very great quantity of gold, but how it is produced, I cannot say for certain either. It is said that one-eyed men called Arimaspians steal it from griffins, but I do not believe this either, that there exist one-eyed men who in every other respect have the same nature as other men. In any case, it does seem that the outermost lands, encircling the rest of the world and enclosing it within, possess the things that seem to us the finest and the rarest. There is a plain in Asia enclosed on every side by a mountain, with 5 gaps cutting through the mountain. This plain once belonged to the Chorasmians, lying on the border of the Chorasmians themselves, the Hyrcanians, the Parthians, the Sarangians, and the Thamanians. But since the Persians have held power, it belongs to the king. From this encircling mountain flows a great river, called the Aix. This river formerly, divided in 5 channels, watered the lands of these peoples just named, being led through a gap to each of them separately. But since they have come under the Persian, the following has happened to them. The king, having built gates at each gap in the mountains where it is breached, closed off the water's outlet, so that the plain inside the mountains becomes a sea, since the river flows in but has no outlet anywhere. So those who formerly were accustomed to use the water, being unable to use it now, suffer a great hardship. In winter, God sends them rain just as he does other men, but in summer, when they sow millet and sesame, they need the water. So whenever none of the water is given over to them, they go to the Persians, both the men and their wives, and standing at the king's gates they cry out howling. And the king orders the gates that lead to their land opened for whichever of them are most in need. Then, when their land has drunk its fill of water and is sated, these gates are closed again, and he orders other gates opened for whichever of the rest are most in need. As I gathered from what I have heard, he charges enormous sums for opening them, beyond the standard tribute. So that is how matters stand there. Among the 7 men who revolted against the Magus, one of them, in Tafrens, brought about his own death right after the revolt through an act of arrogance. He wanted to go into the palace and speak with the king on business, since the custom at the time allowed those who had joined the revolt against the Magus to walk in unannounced ahead of the king without an announcer, unless the king happens to be with a woman. Intafrens did not think it right that anyone should announce him, but since he was one of the 7, he wanted to go in. The doorkeeper and the message bearer would not allow it, saying that the king was with a woman. Intafrens, thinking they were lying to him, did the following. Drawing his short sword, he cut off their ears and nose, and looping them onto his horse's bridle, fastened them around their necks, then released the men. They presented themselves before the king and explained why they had been treated this way. Darius, worried the six had acted together in agreement, summoned each one individually and probed his thinking, asking whether he endorsed what had happened. Once he discovered that Intafrens had not done this together with them, he seized the man himself and his children and all his household, having strong suspicions that he was plotting rebellion against him together with his kinsmen. And having arrested them, he bound them for execution. But the wife of Intafrens, coming continually to the king's doors, wept and lamented. And by doing this same thing over and over, she moved Darius to feel pity for her. He dispatched a messenger who delivered this message. "Woman, King Darius offers to free one of your imprisoned relatives, whichever you choose among them all." After thinking it over, she gave this reply. "If indeed the king is offering me one life, out of all of them I choose my brother." Darius, hearing this and struck with wonder at her reasoning, sent word back. "Woman, the king asks you what thought you had in mind that, abandoning your husband and your children, you chose to save your brother's life instead. A man who is less close to you than your children and less dear to you than your husband." She answered with these words, "O king, I could get another husband, if a god should so wish, and other children too, if I should lose these. But since my father and mother are no longer living, there is no way I could ever get another brother. It was with this thought in mind that I said what I said." Darius thought the woman had spoken well, and he released for her both the man she had asked for and the eldest of her sons, being pleased with her, but he put all the others to death. So one of the seven perished immediately in the manner described. Now it was about the time of Cambyses' illness that the following happened. Arotes, a Persian man, had been established by Cyrus as governor of Sardis. This man conceived a desire for an unholy deed. For though he had suffered no wrong, nor heard any rash word from Polycrates of Samos, nor even seen him before, he desired to seize and destroy him, according to most accounts, for the following reason. As Arotes was sitting at the king's doors together with another Persian named Mitrebates, governor of the province at Dasylium, the two fell from conversation into a quarrel. And as they were disputing about their merits, Mitrebates said to Arotes, taunting him, "You call yourself a man, when you have not added to the king's realm the island of Samos, which lies right next to your own province. So easy a thing to conquer that one of the local men rose up with 15 armed soldiers, took control, and now governs it as tyrant." Some claim that on hearing this, stung by the insult, Orotes became determined not merely to punish the speaker, but to destroy Polycrates altogether, since it was because of him that Orotes had earned such disgrace. Others, a smaller group, report instead that Orotes dispatched a messenger to Samos requesting some item, exactly what is not said, and that Polycrates happened to be lying in the men's hall, with Anacreon of Teos present with him. And somehow, whether by design he was disregarding Orotes' business, or whether it happened by such a chance, the herald of Arotes came forward and spoke, and Polycrates, who happened to be turned toward the wall, neither turned around nor gave any answer. These are the two accounts given of the cause of Polycrates' death, and it is open to anyone to believe whichever of the two he wishes. Now Arotes, settled in Magnesia, which lies above the river Meander, sent Miasis, son of Gyges, a Lydian man, to Samos bearing a message, having learned Polycrates' intention. For Polycrates was the first of the Greeks we know of who set his mind on ruling the sea, a part going back to Minos of Cnossus, and to anyone else who may have held mastery of the sea before him. But among what is called the human race, Polycrates was the first, and he harbored great ambitions of ruling over Ionia and the islands. Once Orotes realized what Polycrates had in mind, he dispatched a message reading. Arotes speaks thus to Polycrates, "I have learned that you are scheming toward great enterprises, yet your funds do not match your ambitions. If you do as follows, you will both raise yourself up and save me as well. For King Cambyses is plotting my death, and this has been reported to me clearly. Now if you get me and my money out of here, take some of it yourself and let me keep the rest. For the sake of the money, you will rule all of Greece. If you distrust me about the money, send whoever happens to be most trusted by you, and I will show it to him." Hearing this, Polycrates was delighted and willing, and since he desired money greatly, he first sent Meandrius, son of Meandrius, one of his citizens, who was his secretary, to look into it. This man not long afterward dedicated all the remarkable furnishings from Polycrates' men's hall to the temple of Hera. Orotes, learning that the spy was expected, did as follows. He filled 8 chests with stones, except for a very small space near the very rims, and on top of the stones he laid gold, then tied up the chests and kept them ready. Meandrius came and, having seen them, reported back to Polycrates. And though many of the seers forbade it and many of his friends tried to dissuade him, he set out there anyway. And moreover, his daughter had seen a dream vision of this sort. It seemed to her that her father hung suspended in the air, washed clean by Zeus's rain and gleaming under the sun's rays. After this vision, she tried every possible means to stop Polycrates from making the journey to Orotes, and as he boarded the 50-oared ship, she continued shouting out bad omens. He warned her that if he returned safely, she would remain unmarried for a long time. She prayed that this would indeed come to pass, for she said she would rather remain unmarried longer than be deprived of her father. Polycrates, disregarding all advice, sailed to Orotes, taking with him many of his companions, and among them Demos, son of Caliphon, a man of Croton, a physician who practiced his art better beyond anyone else of his generation. On reaching Magnesia, Polycrates met a wretched end, one matching neither his own character nor his lofty ambitions. Setting aside the tyrants of Syracuse, not a single other Greek tyrant deserves comparison to Polycrates for sheer splendor. Orotes put him to death in a manner too shameful to recount and had his body impaled. Those among his followers who were Samians, Orotes set free, instructing them to remember they owed their freedom to him, while the foreigners and slaves among his followers he retained, treating them as captives. Meanwhile, Polycrates, hanging there, brought every detail of his daughter's vision to pass. Zeus bathed him whenever rain fell, and the sun anointed him as moisture rose from his own body. Thus did the many strokes of fortune enjoyed by Polycrates come to such a close, exactly as Amasis, the Egyptian king, had once predicted for him. Some time later, though not much time, retribution for Polycrates caught up with Orotes too. After Cambyses died and the Magi held the throne, Orotes stayed put in Sardis and offered the Persians no assistance whatsoever when their rule was stripped away by the Medes. Instead, amid that disorder, he killed Mitrebates, the governor from Dacylium, who had reproached him over the matter concerning Polycrates, and he also killed Mitrebates' son Cranaspes, both men held in high regard among the Persians. And he committed all sorts of other outrages, and when a messenger came to him from Darius bearing a message that was not to his liking, he killed the man as he was traveling back, setting men to ambush him along the road, and after killing him, he made him disappear, horse and all. Darius, once he had secured the throne, wished to punish Orotes for all his crimes, and especially for those against Mitrebates and his son. He did not think it wise to send an army against him directly, since affairs were still unsettled, and since he had only recently gained the throne, and since he learned that Orotes had great power. For 1,000 Persians served as his bodyguard, and he held the province of Phrygia and Lydia and Ionia. To deal with this, then, Darius devised the following scheme. He called together the most eminent of the Persians and said to them, "Persians, which of you would undertake to accomplish this for me by cunning rather than by force and numbers? For where cunning is needed, there is no work for force. Which of you, then, would either bring me Orotes alive or put him to death? He has never once benefited the Persians, yet he has committed terrible wrongs. For one, he wiped out 2 of our own, Mitrebates and his son. For another, he murders the men I send to summon him, displaying insolence beyond what can be endured. Before he inflicts some even worse harm on the Persians, we must see him put to death." Such was Darius's question, and to it 30 men volunteered, each one willing to do this himself. As they were quarreling among themselves, Darius stopped them and told them to draw lots, and when they drew lots, it fell to Bagius, son of Artaunts, out of all of them. Having won the lot, Bagius did the following. He wrote up many documents concerning many matters and affixed Darius's seal to them, and then went with these to Sardis. When he arrived and came into Orotes' presence when he arrived, He took the letters one by one and gave each to the royal scribe to read aloud. Every governor has royal scribes attached to him. Bagius, testing the spearmen to see whether they would accept revolt from Arotes, gave them the letters. Seeing that they showed great reverence for the letters themselves and still greater reverence for what was read out of them, he handed over another letter in which was written the following: Persians, King Darius forbids you to serve as bodyguard to Arotes. When they heard this, they lowered their spears to him. Seeing that they obeyed the letter, Bagius, now emboldened, handed the last of the letters to the scribe, in which was written: King Darius commands the Persians at Sardis to kill Arotes. When the spearmen heard this, they drew their short swords and struck him down right there, and in this way retribution for Polycrates of Samos finally caught up with Arotes the Persian. Once the wealth of Arotes had been gathered up and transported to Susa, it happened a short while afterward that King Darius, out hunting game, jumped down from his horse and wrenched his foot. The injury turned out fairly severe, since the ankle bone had slipped out of its socket. Believing he had long kept about him those Egyptians reputed to be foremost in the art of medicine, he made use of them. But by wrenching and forcing the foot, they only made the injury worse. For 7 days and seven nights, Darius was kept sleepless by the pain that afflicted him. On the eighth day, when he was faring badly, someone who had earlier heard, still at Sardis, of the skill of Demosthenes of Croton, reported it to Darius. He ordered that the man be brought to him as quickly as possible. When they found him, neglected somewhere among the slaves of Arotes, they led him into the king's presence, dragging fetters and clothed in rags. Set before them, Darius asked him whether he understood the art. He would not admit it, fearing that if he revealed himself, he would be cut off entirely from Greece. It was clear to Darius that he was practicing deception, though he knew the art, and he ordered those who had brought him to bring out whips and goads before him. At that point, he did reveal himself, saying that he did not know it exactly, but that from association with a physician, he had a poor grasp of the art. After that, once Darius entrusted himself to him, using Greek remedies and applying gentle treatments after the harsh ones, he brought it about that Darius could get sleep, and in a short time restored him to health, though Darius had no longer expected to have the use of his foot again. After this, Darius gave him 2 pairs of golden fetters as a gift. Demosthenes asked him whether he was deliberately doubling his suffering as a reward for having healed him. Darius, pleased with this remark, sent him to his own wives. The eunuchs, leading him in, told the women that this was the man who had given the king back his life. Each of them, dipping a bowl into a chest of gold, gave Demosthenes so generous a gift that the servant following him, whose name was Sitton, gathered up the staters that fell from the bowls, and a great quantity of gold was collected for him. Now this Demosthenes, having come from Croton, had come to be associated with Polycrates in the following way. In Croton he was afflicted by a harsh-tempered father. Unable to bear him, he left and went off to Aegina. Settling there, in his first year he surpassed the other physicians, even though he was without equipment and had none of the instruments that belonged to the art. In his second year, for a talent, the Aeginetans employed him at public expense. The following year the Athenians paid 100 minae, and the year after that Polycrates paid 2 talents. This is how he ended up in Samos, and thanks largely to this man, the physicians of Croton built their fame. This took place during the period when Crotonian doctors were said to rank first throughout Greece, with those of Cyrene ranking second. Around this same period, the Argives, too, had a reputation as the leading musicians among the Greeks. It was at this point that Demosthenes, after currying Darius at Susa, acquired an enormous household and became a dinner companion of the king. Apart from a single restriction, leaving for Greece, he had access to everything else. On one occasion, he pleaded on behalf of the Egyptian physicians, who had previously treated the king and now faced impalement for having been outperformed by a Greek doctor. He saved them. In another instance, he saved an Elean seer who had accompanied Polycrates and had been left neglected among the slaves. Demosthenes was a man of the very greatest importance at the king's court. A short time after this, the following also happened. Adossa, daughter of Cyrus and wife of Darius, developed a growth on her breast, which then burst and spread further. As long as it was small, she concealed it out of shame and told no one. But once her condition worsened, she summoned Demosthenes and showed it to him. Promising to cure her, he made her swear an oath that she would repay him with whatever favor he might later request of her, provided he would ask nothing that would bring her shame.